Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com.
Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. Today is July 22nd. My name is Evan Basilek, and if you haven't noticed, I am not Sujit. He is enjoying, where is he this week, Kale?
Bahamas? I think it's the Caribbean. Yeah, Caribbean. Somewhere down there. Yeah.
Somewhere warm and nice and away from everything. But I'm still here, and my colleague, Kale Teeter, is here as well. I work in support, support Azure IaaS scenarios, and then Kale works for the Center of Excellence, right?
Yep. Okay. Center of Excellence for Azure, yeah.
Yeah. We're, you know, here to talk about Azure, so it probably won't be quite as fun without Sujit, but, you know, we'll make it work, right? So what we wanted to talk about today was, you know, kind of bringing in some tales from the field, right? Sort of make it real, but also just kind of share what we see people doing, right? When we've done make it real in the past, we've had somebody that's out there using it. This is kind of a flip on that of what we see other people doing. We also had a couple announcements. One of them is, I guess they're both pretty big. You know, one of them is Visual Studio 2015 is released. This was the 22nd, or the 20th, I think. Is that right? Yeah, on the 20th. So RTM for Visual Studio 2015, and with it comes a brand new SDK for Azure, 2.7. So I don't know, Kale, have you played with, I haven't even touched 2015 or the 2.7 SDK. Have you touched any of the RCs for those? Or?
Yeah, I've been installing those up through the ranks here until we got to RTM, but I haven't done a lot with the SDK because that was just announced. So, but it looks like some exciting stuff. There's some new Cloud Explorer that's going to be in there. A lot of Resource Manager and those types of tools have been integrated. But the one tool that was kind of stood out for me, and I haven't had a chance to play with it yet, is the Azure Data Factory. So they've actually integrated and created actual templates. So inside Visual Studio 2015, you'll see a node in there once you install the SDK for Data Factory, and it actually has a template to kind of walk you through creating some of those pipelines, which I know, you know, from being in the field, customers, they're pretty excited about Data Factory. I mean, it's got a lot of use out there for, like, moving data around, and this is something that we've used SSIS or custom code before, and they're excited about this, but that was, like, the key feedback that I've heard personally was, I don't want to write a bunch of JSON. I mean, it looks great. It's kind of simple, you know, but do you have a GUI for this, or do you have a way to kind of walk me through creating that so I don't make syntax errors and things? So
refresh my memory, because we talked about Data Factory a while back. This is basically the ability to say, here's my source data, you know, here's where I want to move it to. This is, I guess you can do transforms and stuff on it as well, or...
Simple transforms. Yeah, yeah. So you can actually move between different types of data sources too. So you could have like, I think the primary use case was like a big data type scenario where we had unstructured data in files or just out on a file system. It could be databases as well, a relational database or even NoSQL. And then bring those, maybe you have three or four of these different sources and you want to merge them all together into a, like a metaverse or some central data schema that you have. So this tool can help you.
So does this play into, and this isn't really an Azure thing, but does this play into the new Power BI stuff that we're hearing about, where Power BI, you know, what did we call it?
Well, there was something announced here at the Worldwide Project Conference, I think that was last week, the Cortana Analytics Suite, which kind of does some of this too. These all kind of play together, right? Like,
yeah.
So that's all about the middle part there, right, to do analytics once you have the data in there.
Right. Yeah, I think the Power BI was about you could, as a company, publish data sets, right? And anybody can publish and anybody can consume. And so the net result was that you could use Power BI to look at this data without even really knowing whose data it is, right? You can explore for stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's really kind of neat to see. I'll have to admit, I was, you know, I used to support SSIS in days gone by, and I remember us talking about an internal product that was being developed to do this kind of stuff in the cloud. I don't know that it's related to Data Factory or not. It's probably from the same you know, kind of core team. But I remember looking at it going, man, that seems like a lot of work to move all my data up, because it's a lot of data. But now, you know, we're 5 years later, and, you know, the transmission speed is not the problem. The storage is not the problem. So it seems like it makes a lot more sense now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the big hurdle now. Everybody wants to leverage the cloud to do this type of analytic stuff. That's a perfect use case for using the cloud, right? Because you need a lot of compute, but it's kind of spiky workloads. But you need to get your data there somehow, right? So yeah. That's where these things really help.
Yeah, I wonder if it'll be interesting to see if kind of the next phase of this is some of the synchronization stuff, right? Because that really becomes kind of the nirvana, is if I can have my data up in the cloud for these, you know, big analytics jobs, but on premises is maybe where I'm generating it, or, you know, maybe I have something existing on premises that uses it. I don't really want to go through the effort to copy it up every day, right? It'd be nice if I could just kind of diff it, right, and send the stuff that has changed or something. I don't know.
Yep.
You know, so, but yeah, so, but you know, combine all things, when you combine all that together, it's a pretty big week for announcements, right? A couple of big items, right? Normally you have a bunch of littler stuff. So, so moving on then, you know, what we thought we'd do is talk through some things we see people doing, and, you know, talk through, you know, good, bad, you know, maybe variants of doing it. Kale, you want to go with one of yours first?
Sure. Yeah. So most recently I've been working with some people, and ironically we've been working a lot with Azure AD. So it's, you know, I get these things in phases, right? Sometimes people are focused on storage and these kind of things, but just recently there's been a lot of my focus on Azure AD and how do we integrate that with a federation system and, you know, your identity system and all those types of things. And it's something that all the apps need, but, you know, there's a lot of libraries out there, so when the customers first come in and they start looking at how do we put our application up in Azure, right? So that's great to say you can put it up there, but what do we do with the identity? Is it homegrown? Is it using LDAP, like it's been hard-coded to use LDAP, or are they using a framework like WIF or something like that? But we have a lot of tools that are built out there, so hopefully people are aware. We have the ADDLE toolset, the Azure... what's it called? Azure Active Directory Authentication Library.
Yeah.
And that's actually out there. The thing that's cool about that is, you know, obviously when you get multi-tier applications, this is an issue, right? Because we have, not only do we have to authenticate people and do authorization, but we also have to have this work across multiple tiers. And that's probably like the biggest complication that you run into is they say, well, great, I can put it in, let's say, a SPA application. Maybe they're running, crap, it just slipped my mind what the maybe Angular.
You're talking single page app, right?
Yeah, something like Angular or Marionette or something of that nature. So heavy JavaScript, right? So they have this client-side application, and they need to be able to use ADDLE. So we have a JavaScript library out there that you can use to leverage. And really simple, you know, go up and set up your AD tenant in Azure that you want to use this with. Register your application up there and... you know, put this piece of JavaScript in there, and then there's a little bootstrap code you got to write. But there's not a lot of code to get that stuff bootstrapped and get that running. And then it becomes like the question of, okay, so now we have an API behind us, right? So that those things scale independently, right? We can scale the front-end web servers independently of our API, which talks to our data layer. And so now you're like, okay, well, that has to be authenticated, right? We can't have unauthenticated calls going there. And so it's interesting to try to combine those, because there's different ways to kind of do the authorization code on top of that. So if we just looked at the token, right, we log into the SPA app, we set up what I just described, you know, we set up our application in Azure AD, we get a token that we cache there for X amount of time, and every time that we pass that over, we have to make sure that we inject that in an authorization header. So we just add a header for a bearer token, pass that over, and then we can use something like OWIN over on Web API if we're using it, to kind of bootstrap that one so that we can use Windows Azure, the ADDLE library over there, and that's kind of server-side code. And so it can understand what to do with that token, how to validate it to make sure it's good. But the cool piece on top of all that, so once you get the multi-tier working, is like, okay, so what do you do with authorization then? Now we validated their password. We said, yeah, they're the right user, but which API? Yeah, which APIs are they allowed to call? So that's really interesting, because there's many ways to do that, right? You can do it when you generate the token. So over in the SPA app, when we go to generate the token, we can make a callback to, like, let's say we're using groups with Azure Active Directory. We can make a call to Graph, to the Graph API, and say, what groups are these guys in? Just turn them into claims, pack them into token that gets encrypted and sent over, and then the claims are a part of it. So we see that over in the web API, and we can do the comparison there. But I was working recently with a colleague, and he had mentioned that we can actually just do this in the manifest. So when you go up, and when I say manifest, if you're in the portal, once you set up your application up there, there's a little icon at the bottom for downloading your manifest, which basically is a declarative version of what's up there for your application in JSON. But you can set all these properties and things up there to control things. And one of them is you can basically turn on and say any groups that are in Azure Active Directory, go ahead and generate claims for them. So you don't have to write any code. Like, you just go in and change
wow,
that declaratively,
cool.
And it happens. Yeah, it's really cool. I didn't even know that existed.
Well, I guess that makes sense because, I mean, that code is pretty much boilerplate code when you do it, right? I've written some code like that before, and it's literally just find somebody else that's done it similar, cut and paste, and just change them, you know, maybe change the object names to match yours, right? It's not like you're writing new auth code.
Right. Yeah, I think the twist comes, though, like if you get it works great if you're doing, like, groups and you're synchronizing, let's say you're synchronizing your AD up to Azure AD, or if you're just using straight up Azure AD but with groups. But what if it's like the customer says, wait, all my authorization code's in the database and I don't want to change that? That's cool because you can do the other way. So you can just basically, in your application, make a call into your database and then generate claims off of that. So
right.
It's kind of nice you can do both ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny because we're talking about this like a custom app, but, I mean, fundamentally, that's what Office 365 does, right? When you're on-premises, you talk to your Active Directory and your ADFS servers in that are sitting potentially, you know, on-premises or connected to your network directly, maybe not necessarily on-premises. And then when you go to, OWA or you go to SharePoint Online, that's not talking to on-prem necessarily. It's talking to Azure AD.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now it might go to on-prem to talk to ADFS, but once you get that token, then it's going to go talk to SharePoint. It's going to talk to Azure AD to check your group membership and all that kind of stuff. So it's just kind of a smaller version of what we're doing there, right, when you talk about the SPA app. So that's cool. I've written auth code in the past. It used to be ugly. Adal makes it significantly easier.
Yep.
So, cool. Yeah, so something I saw recently, which, you know, we were talking about getting data back and forth, this actually makes perfect sense, but I didn't even think about it until ran across somebody doing this, which was they have, you know, one of these, you know, storage appliances that you can buy on premises. There's a whole bunch of them out there, right? A bunch of different companies make them. But I kind of was saying, well, you know, once we go to the cloud, those just don't exist. Everybody's going to use blob storage. Well, what I didn't think about was for some companies in some environments, they want that data local, right? So maybe they have a heavy use on-premises. And so what these guys did is they've got an ExpressRoute connection between on-premises and Azure, and then, you know, their VMs in Azure can use this appliance just like on-premises. So they have one appliance. They get all the, I guess there's management, central management benefits and the like. Although it wouldn't surprise me if modern versions of these appliances use Azure storage as their back end, right?
So now, is this in something different from, like, the Store Simple devices you're talking about?
It is and it isn't. I don't know a ton about this device that this customer was using, but it sounded really similar, except in this case, they were even accessing it from their Azure virtual machines, right? So,
cool.
Which I guess you could do with Store Simple. Right?
I'm not sure it works that way. Yeah, I thought that was more the other way, right? It would make sure that you cache the heavy use files on-prem, but it would let the other stuff go to Azure, right?
Yeah, that was my understanding as well. But I think, you know, if you think about it, and this is why I thought this was a neat scenario, because we always kind of assume slow to the internet, right? Well, because these guys were doing this over ExpressRoute, it's as fast as my connection to the data center is in my corporate location, right? I mean, this is fiber connections. You know, you're talking basically the speed of light is your limit as compared to internet latencies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is nothing saying they couldn't, if they had virtual machines going to back on premises via ExpressRoute and they were taking advantage, because part of the thing of the Store Simple device, right, is that it caches stuff locally, but it has that infinite storage, right? So you can always go get something, and you're always going to the same file share or volume, right? I don't see any reason why you couldn't do that from Azure, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be just as fast as if I'm going from here to Redmond, right? Because I'm all the way on the East Coast. Might even be faster depending on where my Azure VM is and my local Store Simple device.
Now, you definitely couldn't do like disks and things like that, right? From like an Azure VM couldn't be having its disks on-prem, right? It would be more like a UNC pass or something like that, like share.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of thinking, like, you know, some sort of file server type implementation. I've seen some Store Simple stuff at some of our conferences and everything, but I've never like seen what it looks like from when you use it. I assume it just shows up as a UNC path somewhere.
Yep.
Right. So, I mean, I would think if you're in essence on a connection back to your network that's just as fast as your network, and you're on your network, then I don't see any reason why you couldn't use a Store Simple device in that case. I don't think this customer was doing that. I think they were using something else. But you know, I just had forgotten about how fast these ExpressRoute connections are, and that it opens up some things that. You know, I used to just say, "Oh, you never go back on premises for something like that," mm-hmm. right? So that was kind of neat. So,
cool.
You were talking about a data sync scenario as well.
Yeah, along with the data factory, we talked about that before and stuff. But I had a use case before where this comes up a lot, I think, because there's a lot of difference between. And it's getting smaller now, but between like an Azure SQL database, which is the multi-tenant PaaS SQL, as opposed to something running on IaaS or even an on-prem.
Isn't it like 90%+ compatible now with the V12, I think we're calling it?
Yeah, it's pretty good. But, I mean, there's still certain things, right, that you can't do, like file tables, for instance, or file streams.
Okay.
And
okay.
So one of my customers one time had that scenario of saying, like, yeah, this is all great. We like the PaaS thing, and the performance is there now. I mean, it runs really well. It does everything we need. The issue is we have the dependency on file streams. How do we get rid of that? Like, how could we change that? Well, I mean, there's many options, right? It's like, okay, so let's fix it on-prem. But that's, you know, kind of heavy-handed, right? Because we're going to fix something on-prem here. Why are we messing with the on-prem? They wanted to take it to Azure.
Right.
So then we look at, well, what tools are we using to move between – obviously, you come back to things like SSIS. So then you take a look at, could we modify or create something in SSIS to kind of do this for us? And that's what we ended up doing with one was to say, let's build a custom component in there for Azure Blob Storage, and then we'll take those file streams and we'll put them in Azure Blob Storage. Obviously, when we do that, when we're writing them over, it's not just as simple as writing them over. We have to write them over, then we have to receive the URI back, and then we can pack that in a table, which is very similar to what FileStream's doing in SQL Server, right?
Yeah.
So that's what we ended up doing, and it worked out really well. Like, basically just built some custom middleware there, and then we could run these packages to migrate data, or not even migrate data. We could have it running real-time. We kick off these packages to publish data up to Azure, and it would be in the right format.
Now, were these big blobs or relatively small? Because, I mean, like, if you think about a file, typical length of time for a, you know, say a file upload, a SQL transaction is not going to be very happy with that.
So
typically smaller things. Or how'd you deal with that size, the size issue?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things there, right? Because when you deal with blob storage, they're a little different than writing to like a file API in Windows, right? Because we can break these up into chunks. We can do parallel operations.
Oh yeah, that's true. I forgot the parallel stuff. Yeah.
So that's what we ended up doing with those. But yeah, I mean, there's limits to what we have to do, what we can do there. We have to watch about upper limits there and make sure we don't hit that kind of stuff. But for this, we were way, way under that bar.
Okay.
Of, you know, like a 200 gigabit block blob or something like that. If we hit that limit, I mean, obviously we could get around it because, we just have to create multiple, up there to store that. But, for us, it was way under that bar. Yeah, we were talking about things from maybe a megabyte up to maybe 15, 20 megabits, something like that.
So still relatively small, in the way we talk about files these days. Because I can't believe we call a 15 meg file small, right? How times have changed. I thought when you talk about data sync, you were going to talk about one of my favorite products that I love to hate, which was data sync. data sync service, which I don't, I have to go check. I don't know, did that thing ever GA?
I'm not sure about that. Yeah, I mean, it's out there. I know people that are using it.
Yeah, it's been one of those products that never quite came out of a preview.
Yeah.
I think we called it beta back then, and we hadn't even come up with really using preview as the term. It's funny because I like DataSync. It did some really cool things. It just had some real challenges, and it has never come out, again, to the best of my knowledge, it's never come out of preview support. But, you know, one of the things you talk about in the, we always talk about in the cloud is, like, you can throw things out there and try them. But, you know, when you're a company like Microsoft or Amazon or some of these other big ones, when you throw something out there and you get a bunch of people that adopt it, it's kind of hard to say, well, we changed our mind. We're not going to use this. Right? So I do wonder if over time, as now, it's not just startups selling things, because when a startup goes out, they go out, right? They're out of business, they're out of business. But when, you know, the odds of Microsoft going out of business are pretty slim, so there's always going to be some customer somewhere that takes a dependency on something we throw out there to see how it sticks, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, I wonder what that's got to be a tough thing to think about, you know, when you're a feature team trying to work on something.
Yeah, I know that enterprises, a lot of my work with are always asking that question. Like, that's a very popular question, really. Like, to say, we like these features, right? These seem really cool. Whether it's storage or, like you're talking about, synchronization tech or something like that, the primary question always is there a non-prem equivalent of this? Like, I just want to make sure. Is there something else? Like, is there another way to run it, you know? And so it's always interesting. That always pops up, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, do you find that becomes a blocker, or more that's just a fear, or have you found that to be a real problem? Like, I mean, from the years I've been doing cloud stuff, I see us throw a lot of things out there. I can't think of anything that we've, off the top of my head, that we just absolutely just killed, right? With the exception like caching, right? We had our own caching.
Yeah, I was just going to say,
something
App
else.
Fabric. Yeah, Fabric was the big one, yeah. Because I know a lot of people were using App Fabric, and then it was just like, okay, we're not, you know, there's going to be there's an end of life here, you know, and...
Yeah.
So that was a big one, but no, I mean, I don't think it's a blocker. I think it's they're not used to it yet.
Yeah.
And the one thing is, and the primary reason is, I don't want to be locked to a cloud vendor.
Yeah.
Like, you can do something really special. Is that portable? Can I take that to Amazon? Can I take that to Google? Will it work? What do I have to change? How much do I have to change? You know.
Yeah, I gotta think that's part of why IaaS has exploded, and PaaS. I mean, PaaS is great, but PaaS is locked in. Right, I don't know. I think Amazon has their own kind of equivalent, but you can't take a Microsoft PaaS solution and drop it on to the Amazon cloud or vice versa.
Yeah, I think you could spin it a bit. I'm not spin it, but I think it is possible to do a little bit. I mean, it's not perfect, right? So if you took something like storage, very simple, and you said, Azure has blob storage, and Amazon has S3 storage, and I don't know what Google's is, but they all have these APIs, right, that they write to, and they're all similar, but they're not the same, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, and the thing was, okay, and what's the on-prem equivalent? Well, a file system, right? So maybe Windows file system, let's say. So in that model, I would say, well, let's write a shim, right? Let's write an interface in here that we can use, and then if it turns out we don't want to write to blob storage, we want to write to S3 storage, great. Then we'll just write that little shim, but we don't have to change our code. Like, the code out that's using all this stuff doesn't change.
God, that brings back a memory. When I was first learning SQL, one of the things I got asked to do as some little new hire, right, you know, junior guy, didn't know anything, they said, go write code that can run against SQL, Oracle, and Access with no changes at the application layer. And that's when I first learned of Data Factory and IDB connection and IDB command, like kind of the basic interfaces. Now, I thought that was really cool, but that's exactly what you're talking about, right? You're interface layer is constant, and it's just what's underneath it that you change.
Yeah, and caching's the same. I've seen, especially when the App Fabric thing came out, a lot of people, you know, they were not happy about it because they said maybe I had some stuff I was using App Fabric, but it wasn't that big a change for a lot of the guys who knew what they were doing, right, because they had already written a cache manager, right?
Yeah.
So it's just like, okay, we'll write a Redis cache manager, and then we'll put the config values in there, and we're good to go.
Yeah. Well, I guess that falls down to those of us that not even those of us, because I clearly don't write code this way. If you write code the way you're supposed to do, all this stuff is centralized in a couple of classes. But very few of us write code that way. It's really easy to write, I'll just write this procedural code, right? And then 2 years later, you're stuck with this spaghetti stuff, right? So, no, that's cool. Another thing that I saw, that this was something I actually thought was a really neat solution to a problem, which is, right, so we talked about remote. Did we do a session on remote app? I can't remember. If not, we may need to. But, you know, remote app is basically remote desktop services in the cloud. The problem, though, is with remote app, and RDS has this problem on premises as well. If you want to upgrade your application, you have to basically create a new image, right? And that means you have to customize it and all that. I ran into somebody who was using AppV plus remote app plus Azure. Well, remote app implies Azure, sorry. Plus Azure storage underneath it. So what they did was they used AppV to look into storage for their packages, their AppV packages, and because basically the only thing that was on the remote app client was the AppV client, and the AppV client on startup would go get these packages, They never had to build a new image. They just upgraded their AppV package. And because the AppV package isn't really on the image, they don't have to update the image at all. They just update the package that's in storage.
That's really interesting.
Yeah,
cool.
I thought that was a really, like, I'd never thought, like, there's a couple guys of mine that sit near me that do AppV, and that's, we were talking about, you know, could you do this, and then, you know, ran into this person that was doing this, and I thought that was a great solution to some of the problems of image creation, and really taking advantage of some of the, you know, the ability to kind of tie these different things together and make this solution that leverages the best. I mean, our remote app is awesome, because you don't have to scale up, you scale down, it just scales based on your usage. Right, so you get all the benefits of that, you get the versioning benefits of AppV, and you get the storage benefits side. That just seemed really cool. Right, I don't know
if it's really
cost effective, but it seemed really cool. So
nice. Yeah, I think one other thing that sticks out in my mind that comes up a lot is logging. I'm always thinking about the other things around it, right? Like, you know, app migration to Azure is interesting, but there's always a lot of other things that goes around that, right? It's not just about running your app there. It's about how do you manage it and all those kind of things, which kind of goes back to some of the identity stuff and the synchronization, but also logging, right? So we have, like, our own logging suite where we have OpsMan, we have App Insights. App Insights, and so we have all these different things to do it, but, you know, those are all new, right? These things are things that just came out or are still being evolved, and so customers already have things in place. So it's always interesting to kind of figure out, like, how that's going to play out, right? If they're using something like Splunk, that's a huge one that's, you know, that everybody uses, an open source type product, and how do you use that with PaaS?
And that,
you know,
is that like a telemetry package? So I'm not familiar with that particular one.
Yeah, so Splunk's like it's an open source tool, but basically it's agent based primarily. So you have an agent that you run on the machine, and it will feed back to a central index server, and then you get multiple of these, and it's very complex. Like, they have a nice setup where they can basically build a cluster, and you can have, you know, basically partition your data so that you can, if you're going to do a query, the searches are really fast and those kind of things. And there's gateways and all that kind of jazz. I mean, it's a very thought out product. I mean, it's pretty mature in the market.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, like, so yeah, with IaaS, no problem, right? We can put the agents out there, no issue. Then you say, well, what about our web worker role kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Not really an issue, right? We can install it in a startup task, get the same functionality, kind of works. Then it's like, what about web apps? And then it's like, okay, so that's a different animal. Like, how are we going to, we can't install an agent out there, right? So
yeah.
In those models, and what I've been working with mostly now is, you know, doing this thing where we're leveraging Azure Diagnostics. So we can say, okay, great. So we'll have our web logs being dumped up there on our website, but then we'll have them scraped over into Azure Blob Storage. And then it turns out that the Splunk community has built a PaaS tool basically in Splunk to allow, like, your Splunk server to reach out and actually go the other way. So it'll reach out to that blob storage and pull that data back. So it'll go out and scrape that every so often and bring that into the index. So you can get the same functionality. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I've just been playing recently with App Insights and have been really impressed so far. I wrote a little app internally that, partnered with a guy to write a little app internally that sets my OOF on and off every day, because in our cloud model, we're 24/7, right? So I never know when my customer is going to come back. And so we have to have a way to let them know, you know, who to contact. And we just got tired of trying to set it manually. And I just, like, it was literally four lines of code to turn on, to integrate App Insights. And then it was, you know, it's like one extra line of code every time I throw an catch an exception, or if I'm going to log a specific thing, it's one line of code, and it's trivially easy. And now I have this, and I'm actually looking at it right now, because I was kind of curious how many users we have of this tool now. I mean, I get all these rich, fancy graphs, and you know, for like nothing.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. No.
Yeah. There's been some changes too to the App Insights. I ran into that just recently. So it used to be when it was in VSO, that's where that stuff got born. There was like a client side, right? So that was the one everybody knew, that it was either JavaScript or, you know, something in C#. But there was a client piece that was there, and there was a key involved and that kind of thing. But then there was a server side, right? So you can install this agent like on your PaaS instances and things like that, like a worker role, let's say. And then you could like correlate that data together, which was cool. But now that thing's kind of gone away, is the way I understand it. So that stuff's all been like merged now, so that when you turn on App Insights, it will do all that stuff for you. They're getting that stuff out of the PaaS instances for you. So if you go up and look, you can see like server memory and stuff like that, and you're not deploying agents there.
Yeah, and it looks like we do something similar for like Azure websites as well, right? Where you just say, you know, it looks like, because actually, and I know this for a fact, because on my I updated the Azure Podcast app because I finally got around to putting our actual pictures in it. And there was as I was submitting it in the App Store, it basically said, "Do you want to turn on App Insights?" And I said, "Sure." And we must inject the package, and now I'm getting telemetry on the Azure Podcast.
So, that's cool.
Yeah, and so like we must do something similar for websites and cloud roles, like where the code doesn't change. Right, we're just pulling some basic, you know, kind of standard stuff. So, they're, you know, they can do all that with reflection and you know, injection and stuff. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's really cool, because then you get all the benefit without having to kind of manage the custom implementation.
Yeah,
or you get a lot of the benefit at that point. So, well, no, that's great. I think that was kind of the big ones I had thought of. I mean, you have anything else specific you want to share with the audience tonight, Cale, or?
No, I think that's it. I think we got a lot of, you know, like you said, there's a lot of new stuff that just came out with 2015. So there's a lot of pieces there I think we need to explore and probably talk about in future podcasts here in the near future. I definitely want to talk about Cortana Analytics Suite and see what's involved there. We've talked a little bit. We have a guy slated to come on to talk about machine learning here soon. So that's another interesting area. There's been a lot of focus I see now, like on that aspect, big data, analytics, that type of stuff. So I'm excited to see if we can kind of get some guys from the product group on here to talk about that.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, I agree with you. I think there's a lot of interest in that. The bar to entry for those tools has really come down significantly, right, from where it was. But now those of us that are just kind of users need to learn how to do that. So, okay, well, great. Well, you know, another good week, good show, and we will be back next week, led by our illustrious leader. I think he's coming back next week. Hopefully he's coming back.
With a tan, probably.
So yeah, exactly. And are you going to, I guess we may or may not have you next week at Tech Ready. Maybe, I don't know if he's going. Maybe you guys will manage to hook up out there and we'll kind of do a split session at that point. So.
Sure.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, talk to you next week, Cale.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, stop.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.